Hello and welcome to the EMG Health Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Jonathan Sakia. One of the privileges of doing this podcast is that I get to invite awesome people to have a chat with. Some I've just met, some I've never met, and some I've known a long time. I met Michael Blackhurst a bunch of years ago. He was running a medical device business division of a large company, and we subsequently worked together to help bring a new surgical technology to market around the world. During this time, we developed and deployed plans to train and support those introducing the device to other surgeons. We wrote research protocols, attended medical meetings, visited many countries in Australasia, the Americas, Europe, and beyond. And beyond that, became friends. As such, we shared many life experiences with each other. I came to know Michael as an insightful, smart, and thoroughly decent man. I got to know his family. He's an honest broker who taught me a lot about life, just as I tried to teach him a little bit about clinical surgery. Michael was born in Manchester in England, and his family then emigrated to New Zealand, where he went to school in Auckland and obtained his degree in technology from the very fine university there. He joined a large publicly traded technology company and worked for them for many years, moving through the ranks to a leadership position. But about a year ago, he decided to make a change and now runs his own consultancy, JTJ Services, to help doctors bring their ideas to market. When not working, Michael dedicates a lot of time to his family, enjoys doing projects in his man cave, and he's a very keen mammal, a middle-aged man in Lycra, and cycles absurdly long distances. And it's my great pleasure to welcome Michael Blackhurst to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. And it's an absolute pleasure to be here speaking with you on the EMG podcast, of which I'm a very keen listener over the last year or so since you've been doing this. So first of all, congratulations on the EMG podcast and the team that's supporting you. And thank you for that wonderful introduction.
It's my pleasure. And, you know, you say you've been listening to it. Well, we knew that there was someone who was listening. So
yeah, there's one person. That's me.
So, Mike, after 23 years with one company, you elected to go out on your own. Share with us some of the thoughts behind that, what you think that all of us can learn from what you've surmised, and what you're doing to bring that wisdom to the world.
First of all, 23 years is a significant time. When I think about it, it was one of the biggest decisions I'd made in quite some time, and one that had quite a lot of risk to it, particularly at the time that I was working with a company that was doing just a fantastic job with addressing the healthcare issues with COVID with the respiratory products. And so when I kind of thought about COVID, sometimes something comes along that is so huge that it makes you sit up and actually take a really good look at where you are in your health and with your life and with your career and progress. And I think that was really a situation for me. One of the themes that came up was, if I could do anything right now, would I be doing this job? And I came up with the answer, which was, I don't know. I'd very fortunately had a fantastic career at Fisher & Paykel Healthcare. And when you think about your career and think about moving on, you think, well, what to? And nothing actually jumped out. So I decided that I'd take a sabbatical and kick the can down the road a little bit and then really kind of work into what the next program was. And that's when I really formed JTJ Services. The kind of overarching thinking that I had without having anything specific in mind was really, I enjoyed so much working with clinicians. I enjoyed the contribution you can have to healthcare. And I also recognize that a lot of surgeons and clinicians have some fantastic ideas, but there's a huge barrier for those ideas to get to a commercial stage or even from past a concept stage into a product.
It's a great point because especially, obviously, COVID has interfered all sorts of interactions between all sorts of people. Even prior to COVID, there was this unease amongst certain people that doctors shouldn't be talking to evil industry, that it's a terrible thing. I've always felt that if you have people of diverse backgrounds talking about how to solve problems, you know, someone who's got a technology background, an engineering background, they may go, oh, yeah, well, that's easy. I know how to do that. And, you know, this is something that you really enjoyed, right?
It's definitely a fairly equitable partnership because the healthcare professional may know the problem, but they may not know the solution. And really, that's where the incredible relationships work, when you can have this dialogue together. The engineer can actually understand the why of the fundamental issue and then can come up with some pretty cool stuff to try and solve it. Innovations need, you know, people to talk about it.
Mike, I want to come on and talk about informed innovation a wee bit later. I want to circle back to the first part of my question, which really was, you decided that you couldn't see continuing in what was your current role. You decided, instead of jumping into something else, to take a sabbatical. And I know that you've given a great deal of thought to the way that all of us approach our work lives. And I'd really like to know, because I know what you're up to, I know what you're working on in terms of reevaluating how we choose to spend our lives and what you're planning to do to communicate that to the rest of the world. So tell us a little bit about that.
So, you know, there's a few really interesting, you know, aphorisms that you come across in life that really help to summarize a collection of thoughts. And one of them was, how you live each day is how you live your life. Really meaning that your entire life is really composed of how you live each day. And if each day kind of contains the elements of what you consider to be a good life, and we've all got our own meanings of what that is, then the challenge is, how do you actually curate that? How do you effectively make that happen for yourself? So I went on a journey. I got an executive coach, actually, and she was particularly great in terms of helping me to step back and kind of walk through one's career about what were the moments and the highlights that you really enjoyed, and also to help you drill down to what are some of the really core values that are important to you. I know it's kind of a 101. When it comes to executive coaching, to talk about values. But many of us don't do it. We don't take the time and stop. And some of us don't face enough of a crisis to have that moment where you think, oh, I've really got to start to relook at things. So COVID was that for me. And I worked out that there was about 5 core values that were really important to me. And I've been working through during the sabbatical, trying to make those a reality in the projects that I do and how I spend my time.
It's a thoughtful approach to spending your time instead of drifting from day to day, which I think a lot of people could do with listening to. So do you want to share those values with us?
Sure, I can do. The first thing is, when you do this values, I've been working with quite a number of people in a mentoring capacity and also ask them to look at their values. And it's not easy, because you end up with about 20 and then it's hard to kind of bring it down to a few. So you make sure you're a little bit porous in which ones you choose and not too hard line. So for me, one of the big ones was balance. And I use the word poise because it kind of gives a really good image of like a dancer. The image that I have, Jonathan, is in the beginning of the Austin Powers movie where he's wearing a nice tutu. A nice little pose. But the idea really is to try to find what balance means for you. And I look at it from the perspective of physical health and mental health. And to think about the balance of how you're spending your time with your family. And, you know, thinking about all those things are important to you, but approach them like having an equilibrium. The next one is contribution. And that really drives the projects. It drives the why I was in healthcare, the why I like technology and engineering, and why I like mentoring too. It's really that giving back and enabling other people to be the best that they can be. And that's what I loved about management and leadership, was providing a really fantastic working environment and extrapolating the talent out of people to be the best that they can be. Another one which is interesting is joyfulness. And that is really finding, you know, a little bit of surprise. It's kind of wrapped up in curiosity as well, which is just that thirst to understand something, to actually get to the bottom of something. And I think that's why I've always loved physics. I've always loved medicine and the human body. But also just more of a minimalist and a simplistic approach to life as you get on, you know, being happier with less, being happier with less complexity. And so that's where joyfulness comes in. The whole authenticity approach has always been pretty important to me. That's well known what really that is. And it's trying to make sure that you present the same kind of face and are pretty consistent. And then the last one is really growth. You know, this whole growth mindset, this whole always wanting to improve. And so things like you know, Atomic Habits by James Clear. I read that and I get really excited because I can see, ooh, I can do this and get a 1% gain, and then I can do another 1% gain, and, you know, and things like that. And before you know it, you've actually, through these incremental improvements, you've really made a significant difference. It's kind of been a bit of an introspective journey over the year. And because I had another enterprise going, I was able to have the year to regroup, and that kind of paid for it. Meaning that I did have the luxury of deep diving, but as I've gone through this deep dive project, the kind of project you alluded to earlier, is I've been generating a lot of content. I've been reflecting, I've been reading voraciously, at least 2 books a week, and having some great chats with people. And I'm in the progress of working out what kind of format that could be, whether it's 1, 2, or 3 books or something else.
Having read your writings and some of your ideas, and this sort of mindful approach, we talk a lot about mindfulness, but a mindful approach to the totality of your life, not just drinking your coffee or going to sleep, but the totality of your life. Well, let's circle back to that. And I'm going to also reference COVID again a bit later on, but from a corporate perspective, for doctors, COVID's caused us to rethink how we deliver care, telemedicine, remote sensing, and so on, the pros and cons. If you're in a period of great disruption, whether it's voluntary, as in your case, or enforced by external forces like COVID, how do people identify and leverage the positives and minimize the negatives?
Yeah, that's such a difficult question. The work that the clinicians and healthcare professionals have done is one of the things that I've always respected in healthcare. And through COVID, it's been an incredibly tough time. And I'm in touch with a really great network of doctors and clinicians, and, you know, they've been able to share with me some of the challenges that they've faced. I think there's just a few things to comment on here. When you ask me, how does one identify and leverage the positives? Something like this helps understand is the greater sense of gratitude of the things in our life. Even just physically meeting another person is something that we now get quite excited about. We might have a dinner and you just don't want to leave. You want to stay around chatting. And before COVID, you know, these things were more of an ordeal or things that we had to do part of the time. But that physical contact with people and being grateful for that. And then there's a whole lot of things that we can control. There's that, you know, that whole Stoic idea and all this wisdom that comes back to us from thousands of years is, and popularized again by Stephen Covey, which was, you know, circle of influence, circle of concern, control what you can, and don't worry about what you can't. And there's so much that is outside of our control. So the things that we do have in our control are things like a tendency to doom scroll. I'm not sure if you've heard of that term.
I have not. Educators.
Well, it's just really wallowing in bad news in the media.
Which, of course, has happened a lot during this period of time. People are just fixated on their social media and on news feeds.
Yeah, and, you know, in terms of minimizing the negatives, just having a strategy in place, whether that's I'm going to check these news sites and give it, you know, half an hour or 10 minutes or something, or there'll be times of the day that I won't just naturally go back to that site. And the same thing goes for many of our social media feeds too. Of course, if it's work dependent, that's not really possible. But those kind of things where you can come away not being very sated, leaving it more unhappy than you get it, they're kind of negatives to avoid. And I think really there's another one here where it's, we've all got a tendency to have some internal self-talk. And a lot of that self-talk can be quite negative. So just thinking about being a bit more self-compassionate, trying to stop yourself. And one of the things that I've heard people say is helpful here is, you know, when you hear yourself talking to yourself a certain way, would you ever say that to one of your friends? Would you speak that harshly?
You know, it's a great point, and a lot of people do. I mean, listen, I do it. And, you know, you think confusing humility for self-deprecation, confusing, especially in Britain, where we tend to be a little bit, you know, pejorative about ourselves and our, you know, our approach to the world. It's actually harmful because you are forming a neural net. You're creating a negative loop in your brain and you start to believe your own press, right?
Yeah. And just a final kind of thought on this is really, I follow Gretchen Rubin and the Happiness Project, and she's got these great aphorisms. And one of them is, you can give a lot to others when you give a lot to yourself. Mm. And the healthcare people are giving so much to others. So don't feel guilty about giving a lot to yourself.
That's actually been a theme in a number of other podcasts, especially during this period of time where a lot of healthcare practitioners have, the word burnout is overused. Listen, I had lunch the other day with a dear friend of mine who's really been at the front line of this. And he was sharing with me that he's not in a good place, that he's really struggling with the emotional overload of caring for others and has got nothing left for himself or his family, frankly. Let's move on. I want to talk a little bit about product development a little bit later, because I'm sure there are people listening who've either have invented stuff or innovated or wish to do so. A number of years ago, my most excellent friend, Bruce Jingles, who I introduced you to, and I edited a series of papers for the surgical literature on the topic of innovation. And you authored an article that addressed how doctors might commercialize ideas by working with large companies. And as I say, I bet that some people listening in might want to get in touch with you to benefit from your wisdom. Without giving everything away, what are some gems you can share and advice to people who want to innovate?
So the paper was in surgery, and it was called Optimizing the Success of Surgeons, Innovating and Commercializing Ideas, 10 Lessons Learned. And the devil's in the detail with all this, but I left the article with three big tips. And I guess from the side of the surgeon, you've come along, you've got this fantastic idea. First thing to do, protect it. Make sure there's a very clear delineation between what's your idea and what's not. And the best way to do that is to put it through a patenting process. Or as Jonathan, maybe in the future, it might be minting a non-fungible token, but we can get to the future of that later. The other thing, as a surgeon coming to talk to a company, it is a different world. And there are different strategies, there's different cultures, different focuses. So it's really important to, I guess, keep in the back of your mind that when you want to take this great idea, there's a lot of complexity with regulations, with physically building something. So just, I guess, having a bit of empathy and respect for those that are taking it from the concept to a product. The third gem would be really about, it's a long-term project. There's a misconception that a new product can actually, you know, take the idea and get it built, and then, hey, presto, people will just buy it. I think some of the data shows it can be 19 years from an idea to actually start making the mainstream. And throughout that entire journey, there's so many opportunities for it to fail and to face challenges in regulatory situations or superseding technology or competition or the landscape not being as wide as you thought because other people have got similar patents. So the three ideas there is protect the idea, have empathy for the organization you're working with, and then settle into a nice long marathon.
And it can be a marathon indeed. And sometimes it's a marathon that runs into a brick wall. I remember someone once telling me that if an idea, you know, if people poo-poo it, probably means it's a great idea and it's really disruptive. And if it's obvious to everyone, then it's probably too late.
Exactly.
There was another of my dear friends who I introduce you to, Paul Ferris, and I'm hoping to get Paul onto this podcast to discuss the informed innovation approach. But tell us what you learned about that and explain what that means and what you got from it from working with Paul.
Oh, yes. Paul is an inspiration and taught me a significant amount of the innovation process he calls insight, informed innovation. And it's really those three words. In summary, what it really does is it takes you far beyond any known and superficial problem-solving technique. It takes you to the point where you are an observer of the environment, be it the operating theater, and you simply observe. And through different people having kind of different focuses, you can pick up a heck of a lot of what happens really minute to minute. And it's from that observation that you start seeing, wait a minute, there could be something here and there could be something here. Well, why do they do that? And what's the purpose of that? And you're really trying to get through to distinguish three different things. Is there an unmet need happening? Is there a unarticulated need happening, or is there an underserved need? So the underserved is a workaround. So somebody's connecting a tube with another kind of tube because the connector's broken, and that's just what they do. That's not the solution, but it's good enough, so they don't worry about it. Unmet is when you can say, hey, what's your problem? I need this fixed. It's fully conscious and top of mind and obvious that anybody could really do. And there's probably a number of ways to fix that. The real gold is in the unarticulated. And Paul's process is really a thorough process where you can actually figure out that there are some unarticulated needs here. You know, it's getting to the point where you would never be able to articulate the need for an iPad. That comes with a great deal of insight of what could be next. You know, the classic Henry Ford, ask people what they want, they'll tell you, but it will be a faster horse, right, rather than something else. Paul's approach really helps you to go to depth, have it recorded, and be able to look back on it over years. And a couple of colleagues and I looked at ours about 18 months ago, and we realized that we were kind of 5 years into the 10-year program of development. And pretty much everything that we'd thought about since then was on the roadmap that we worked through with Paul. We actually were quite surprised because we thought, oh, we'd thought about this stuff, but no, we'd actually through that exhaustive program, and we'd got a very multidisciplinary team involved, sales reps, clinical staff, marketing, engineers, even operations staff to support us with the thoroughness of that process. And once you've done it once, you really start thinking that way. And at the end of the day, what it does, it means that you de-risk the chance that you end up with the wrong product.
Yeah, I remember when I first met Paul, I'd taken an idea to him and I wanted someone to make me a prototype. And he said, how do you know that this is a problem that really exists? Maybe it's just your problem. And, you know, as with surgical arrogance, I said, well, if I can't solve this problem without a new device, I'm sure everyone is the same. And he said, okay, well, if it is a problem, who says this is the right solution? And it really stopped me in my tracks. So for the benefit of the folks listening, Mike and I talk regularly, and I always come away educated, usually with a new lexicon. And in one of our recent very rich conversations, you're explaining the future of healthcare and what it looks like in metaverse. Why don't you do that now for our broader audience? Because my face when you mentioned it was, what?
Yeah, and it's the jargon that is becoming much more into our language now without really discovering what it means. And it's probably become the best word to describe it, but it's not the only word to describe it. To give you a perspective, it's kind of like thinking that you are going to be now immersed in the internet. And where we were 25 years ago, before the internet, you could laugh about how it would affect your life. You could feel that you could avoid it. And we look now at 25 years since the internet, and there's very little that we don't do that involves the internet. And the same thing goes for healthcare. If you stop and think about what the internet has done for healthcare, it's transformed it. Electronic records, being able to have phone consults, or at least Zoom consults, whether we have an opinion on that as good or bad, it's possible. The whole ability to get healthcare bookings, to you name it, there's so much that we do with the internet, it's not possible to list at all. Take that one step further. When we talk about the metaverse, meta kind of means beyond the universe. And we think about it as an immersive internet. And we think about, well, what does that look like for healthcare? What kind of things would be valuable? Is it better training? So the technology might get to the point where using VR headsets is so good for being able to train surgeons in all sorts of places. Enabling technologies like Elon Musk's Starlink satellite constellation, where so much of the world that isn't urban will be able to get access to high-speed, high-quality internet to get training and to get access to things that others can't. When it comes to healthcare, you know, maybe there's, I think we always will want a person. I think that's what COVID's done for us. We recognize that we need to see a person sometimes. But when we think about our banking, we don't need to see a person for every transaction. we do when we need to, you know, get a new mortgage or do something complex. But there'll be a lot of things you can do interacting either a lower trained person or even an AI. And then there'll be a lot of tools and Internet of Things based technology that will enable us to gather much more information to make decisions. So, I mean, I don't really have an answer, except it's a really exciting space. And if you think about all the trends that were around for the internet, it's that all over again in a much more immersive space where you can have a much more present virtual and digital presence. And you can take that to whatever platform you're on, whether it's VR, whether it's a 3D screen, whether it's your 2D platform with your smartphone, the continuity between your real and digital lives will be a key aspect of the metaverse. And therefore, you'll have other depths. Geography won't be a problem. Cost might be reduced. There's one company I know here in New Zealand that is transforming phobias through immersion techniques with a VR headset. And the first phobia they're trying to overcome is, and that's the name of the company, is overcome fear with needles. So for those wanting to be vaccinated, the next one is your ideas around flight and heights and things like that. There's a lot of, I think, depending on how creative you are, you're going to be in a position to do a lot more creative solutions.
Well, so you mentioned a little bit earlier, non-fungible tokens. And I remember when you mentioned this to me again, I seem to say this a lot with you. What? Talk to us about blockchain and non-fungible tokens or NFTs in healthcare. I hope some are as clueless as me. Please educate us, sir.
Okie dokie. So the blockchain is really a chance to record something on a ledger. So less chance of fraud and everything's unique. And now you've got that kind of unique ledger. It can be applied in ways such as cryptocurrencies. And there's many different chains, many different currencies, very different ways of going about things, but it's all built on that blockchain. And also unique digital assets, which is what a non-fungible token is. Tim Berners-Lee, who wrote the source code for the internet when he was at CERN, he recently turned his source code and other peripheral documents, including, I think it's quite a spooky video of him typing in the source code for about half an hour or something. He sold that on Sotheby's for over $5 million. Somebody wanted to buy it because it was a unique item. The idea of a non-fungible token means that you can actually own an asset and trade that asset or earn an income from that asset. So to give you an idea, when it applies to the metaverse, traditionally, if you are on a game and you acquire features for your avatar, be it, you know, a Metallica t-shirt, and you want to wear that as you're playing a game, it's pretty cool. And having that stored as an NFT means that you'll be able to transfer that into other games. You'll be able to even wear that to a job interview if you wanted to. So there's now, shopping, gaming, currencies, there's all kinds of areas that are making use of what this enables. And in terms of healthcare, it's really interesting what will happen in terms of what could these digital assets mean. Could it be that you could mint your own healthcare record and have that with you wherever, and it's unique and protected, and you can share that with various people you control who sees it? Or it could be, I mentioned before, you could mint an NFT of an idea, like the source code for the internet. Or Jonathan, you come up with a great idea, and we say, actually, let's mint that as a digital asset, and then let's find someone to sell that to. It could be an alternate pathway to traditional patenting. It could be cheaper. There could be less barriers to having other legal services involved. The sky's the limit, really. But there is a series of technologies that are coming together, supporting metaverse, NFTs, blockchain technologies, having digital property, taking things from one universe of a game into another one. So I think the same thing could happen with healthcare. And I was thinking before, what if one of the big hospital chains in the US decided to, have its own currency, like a Bitcoin, for that hospital group? And what if it chose to mint some of its services and sell those off to other areas and use this technology to improve healthcare and share services, but have the person that generated it get a royalty at the same time? So lots there. I hope I haven't overcomplicated it. It's quite a rabbit hole.
So I think about JTJ's services, your new enterprise, and how you'll guide people. I always found in our interactions, as we were looking to do something seemingly fairly humdrum, which is got an invention that solves a medical problem, we've got to make the piece of kit, we've got to conduct research to validate it, we've then got to communicate that to doctors, train nurses in how to use it, sell it to hospitals. So, you know, all those steps are fairly well-worn. It's a well-worn path. What are you going to be doing in your new enterprise to help doctors who have an idea bring it to fruition? What do you think distinguishes what you do, other than you're a very insightful guy, as I said at the beginning?
What I'm hoping to do is to really help clinicians in what they wish to achieve and to try and de-risk the process, to be an advisor, maybe to be an investor in enterprises, to support the startup. I've got a commercialization course, which is based on the key points of that innovation paper. And it's really just a 101 of how to help surgeons navigate the path forward, surgeons, students, entrepreneurs, really in a advisory capacity. I've done the operational side for 23 years, and having stuck with the same family of products for a long time, you kind of have a bit of a futuristic view. You kind of know what's next. You know what's happening down the long term. And you can then think of ideas now for the guys to make sure they don't make a mistake in the future. Because a lot of these guys that are starting off this journey, it's their first time through. But also because I've always been very hands-on with the enterprises I've done, whether it's been the clinical program or getting to the hospital or the engineering. And one of the things that it's taught me is getting out there with clinicians, you really get a sense of what it's all about. And you can really see the importance of the work that's being done. And you really want to try and reduce the challenges that they have as they fundamentally try and improve somebody's life. And you're just trying to make sure that what I'm trying to do with JTJ is to have empathy for the surgeon and the idea and just help them work through the next stages of bringing that from concept to product.
Okay. Well, maybe we can put a means of contact on the show notes so that people can get hold of you. And I certainly know where I'm going when I've got my next idea for an innovation. Mike, I've been privileged to visit your very beautiful country. I'm talking about New Zealand here, not Manchester, although I've been there a bunch of times.
The wonderful, wonderful city. It's got a great football team.
Yeah, we've got two great football teams.
No, just one.
All right, well, let's not get into that. I love New Zealand, and I believe the Maori name for New Zealand, well, originally for the North Island, but now all of it is, and I'll murder the pronunciation, is Aotearoa, the land of the long white cloud. Is that the right pronunciation?
Yes, yes.
Jolly good. I practiced. So if a Maori deity surprised you by appearing and granting you three wishes to improve human health, what would they be, Mike?
That's a great question. So I came across a great book by Bronnie Ware, and it was about the five regrets of the dying. And it's had such an impression on me, particularly through COVID. And that was also one of the catalysts. So of the five, I've chosen three. So what I'd wish is for people to allow themselves to be happy. One of the big regrets was that people don't allow themselves to be happy. And it's such a challenge at the end of your life to think that. The next would be, I wish I'd had the courage to live a life true to myself, not the life others expected of me. So just to feel that, I think it's healthy to feel that you have agency, to do what you really want to do, what's meaningful to you. It doesn't matter what somebody else necessarily thinks, of course, as long as it doesn't harm them. And the last one was, I wish I hadn't worked so hard. And I think I've been living that this last year with a sabbatical. So it's a great one because you can be so enmeshed and so engaged in a job that may not be matching what your values are. And that's the chronic stress that leads to burnout. So when we say to improve human health, don't work so hard. But if you are working hard, make sure it's on those things that are really meaningful to you, because then it doesn't feel like work.
Yeah, that's right. Boy, was that great thing that happiness is when you're doing something you're good at or something you like, or preferably both. And unhappiness or stress is where you're doing something you're not good at, you don't like, or worst case, both. So wonderful insights. Mike, thanks so much for joining us today and sharing your calm and solid wisdom. I've treasured our friendship and hope that you'll come back again in the future when your book or books and other projects are further along and we can speak publicly again.
Well, thank you very much, Jonathan. And it's been a really great chance to have a chat. Thanks so much.
You're welcome. Well, folks, that's it for now. Please join us next week for another episode of the EMG Health Podcast. Until then, stay safe, stay well, stay curious, and as Mike suggested, be kind to yourself. Bye for now.